It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Yeah, well, I don't think this one needs as much introduction, and I don't even know if it necessarily needs the TV Guide intro, but it's essentially Alice in Wonderland, a bored girl daydreams herself into an absolute hallucination that takes her through some crazy visuals and then gets spit back out on the other end and continues on with her life at the end.
Okay, I'll just that's it. That's how we start today. We start that before the intro. Now you already know the plot. This is the occult Disney series here with Matt. Joining me as usual is Thomas Lawrence, the paranoid American. Good evening, morning, whatever it is.
Good evening for me. Good morning for you.
That's right. If people really care, I don't know. I rarely care what time of day it is when I listen to a podcast, I guess. I mean, for me, I do. For the people on the podcast, I don't be like.
I feel like it's helpful for me to know if the person I'm listening to is awake in the middle of the night versus, I don't know. It helps to know if the person's an absolute night owl and is never even awake during daylight hours. that might make a slight difference on the tone of the podcast, I think.
Yeah. It's like tomorrow morning, I'm actually getting up for a 6 a.m. podcast call. So the fun thing there is like, I don't remember anything I said. So when I listen to it later, it's all new to me.
it's pretty early for a podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You know, I'm in Japan and UK podcasters, we have like, it's 10 p.m. for them. That's like as late as they can go. Right. And it's 6 a.m. for me. So once daylight savings time kicks in, it's like slightly nicer. It's 7 o'clock, but still, yeah.
The most convenient overlap is just extremely inconvenient for both people.
Right. It's great to have, like, you know, a diverse international selection of guests, but it's also nice to not wake up at 5:45. But yeah, today, Alice in Wonderland. You've already heard the plot. We did that already. I guess is the first of the Disney films that just really has its whole life of its own. I mean, we could cut the Disney movie out completely, and there's still like just plenty going on with Alice in Wonderland, with the book, other adaptations, you know, the fact that we use words from it in our everyday vernacular, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there was a couple of cool things that came out of this. So apparently Alice in Wonderland is the third best-selling book after, I guess, the Bible and some other. Oh, Shakespeare. Like, if you were to add all the works of Shakespeare in the Bible, I guess Alice in Wonderland comes in third. And then it also comes in something like second after the number of words used from a literary work, again, after Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. So again, like, outside of the Disney adaptation, this thing has a lot of staying power. It's had a lot of other movie adaptations that predated the Disney one and, you know, have come after the Disney one. So there's no... This is one of the few ones where Disney didn't necessarily keep anything going or keep anything alive. They were just kind of like adding their hat onto the pile with a really great adaptation of it, for sure.
It's pretty iconic in that if you do think about Alice in Wonderland, chances are you're going to think about the Alice from this movie, because in the book illustrations, she's like dark haired, right? And then there's, you know, the whole wild story. There's movies made about the making of the book, right?
Yeah, and originally the book was drawn by Lewis Carroll, but all of his illustrations were just far too sad and depressing looking, so he had hired someone else to do it, which became somewhat of the iconic black and white versions that you're used to seeing the clip art of outside of the Disney renditions.
Ah, so they used Carroll's original illustrations for the 2010 movie.
I mean, you joke, but honestly, some of the craziest stuff from that movie where I was like, why did they add this? And I look it up, it was like, oh, because that was actually what happened in the book. So it was more true in some cases and obviously less true in others.
Yeah. And with the book, I do kind of feel like Looking Glass actually has more of the stuff that everyone loves, which it, they put, you know, Disney put a fair amount of it into this movie, right? With
most of the adaptations that we've seen, a lot of the movies and TV shows and everything, they kind of cherry pick from a lot of the different aspects. Because I think the original book didn't even have the Mad Hatter in it, which is a lot of people's favorite character. And that was kind of added for publication reasons, right when like the very first kind of written version came out. And then there was like additional poems that had come out, you know, the Jabberwocky was another one. And it just depends on which adaptation you're watching on how, you know, how far they kind of scope through all the breadth of Alice in Wonderland. Cause I don't think any of them encapsulate every single idea. There's just too much stuff going on.
Since we've been doing these films in order though, you mentioned it with Cinderella, I noticed a little bit, but this one you definitely notice, like the animation's great, but it is dumbed down so much from the, you know, high intensity labor intensive stuff from the early 40s and late 30s. I mean,
taking some shortcuts, but I also think that they're starting to realize what looked good and where to spend some of their time. But there were very obvious places where the artwork was and the animation was way better production quality. For example, the very ending, where they're walking away, kind of like walking off into the sunset, there's a much higher frame rate. It's like almost entirely rotoscoped. It looks, you know, really phenomenal. The shading and like the level of detail as they go off into the distance and almost all of the other aspects, it looks great again, but it's missing some of the shading. It's missing some kind of extra in-between frames of animation, I think. But again, for the time period, man, I get watching it and realizing when this came out in like 54, it would have been phenomenal, you know, like you would have been comparing it to, you know, staring at paint dry, essentially. So this would have been amazing. I mean, if you're comparing it to like the most modern 3D sort of animations, and, you know, it doesn't hold a candle depending on what your preference is, but it's still way more work than you probably are used to seeing in like Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah. Well, the big standout's the design, because your 3D, you know, computer CGI movie definitely probably doesn't have as good designs as this. Just like, you know, they put the money into what, like the backgrounds and stuff, right?
Yeah, that matte painting, which was its own, you know, still is its own art form, slowly dying, but it's still around.
I think I was catching some reuse of the animatics from the pink elephants at the end with the car. It's just something, you know, working out an eye for this sort of thing now.
Maybe this is where they were first starting to figure out how to do their reuse, because I think it's going to start being a lot more heavily pronounced in the future movies. We're going to start seeing like almost frame for frame identical movements and rotoscoping, and then just, you know, changing accessories and faces.
Yeah, I guess you got to build up your library before you can start doing that anyway. So
I don't hate it. Honestly, I think it's fine. It's, if you're watching a movie, if the whole entire thing is just, you know, the exact same movie, just everyone has different outfits and a different theme, it's one thing. But for, you know, certain scenes and certain little animatics, I don't think it's really that big of a problem.
No, it's like an Easter egg at some point, right?
So I wanted to mention, too, that before we were talking about the book actually has some really cool facets of it that I haven't read it in its entirety in a very long time, but there was a couple things that stand out. But also, I think we would be doing a disservice to the whole episode if we didn't talk about sort of Lewis Carroll a little bit in his own right, and how creepy and freaking weird of a dude he was.
Yeah, like I said, they've had, you know, like movies just about that, haven't they? So
I watched a handful, and it's funny because there's still a pretty wide gamut. There's the Lewis Carroll or the Charles Dodgson apologists, which are the ones that are basically, it comes down to, oh, well, Victorian era, it was a different time. You know, people, it was different customs and norms. Another one that comes up is that the age of consent was like 12 or something in his area and his time period. Which doesn't make it less creepy, but it's still like one of the things that I guess the apologists come out with. And then the last one is that there's been no direct proof. But after a lot of the different, you know, little documentaries and BBC articles and everything, it does seem that there is overwhelming proof, like with beyond the shadow of a doubt, from almost all the experts, from like the type of, because for anyone that's not aware, Lewis Carroll, despite the fact of being the author of Alice in Wonderland and most people linking him to that, he was also a prolific photographer. He was a mathematician that came up with all sorts of like little math and logic, sort of like theorems that still exist. But in his photography, which he also took pictures of, you know, like nobility and celebrities and like, you know, popular people of the time. But I think over 60% of his catalog was like children, nude children. And they did a whole bunch of like analysis on things that they had found out like many years after he had died, and like absolutely proven that the type of photography techniques used, the camera used, the paper used, the development techniques, everything matched up to some of the photos that he took, that even at the time, considering all of the custom norms and everything for the time period, were still way outside the realm of acceptable. And there was a direct riff, because he wrote Alice in Wonderland named after a girl named Alice Little, and she had a few other sisters. She was essentially the daughter of the dean of the college that he worked at as a math professor. And according to Alice Little's mom, the mom said that at a certain point, Lewis Carroll just became, you know, quote, too affectionate towards his daughter, and they just severed all relations with him. And I think that he didn't come around for like a few years. And then when he did, it was, you know, a whole different dynamic, essentially. And he was never allowed to be around any of the kids alone again. So there was some undocumented, that's the thing that's like unproven, is that there's this undocumented thing that happened that caused this huge schism between him and the family of Alice that he based this whole book around.
Yeah, I mean, even the Nottingham Victorian era, right? The BBC, you mentioned the BBC, and that's got its own, you know, sordid underbelly, of course. So it's not like this is a new thing.
Not at all. And it's weird, just because there's a lot of different levels that you can read into the original book and then the later adaptations. One of the more interesting, like some of the boring ones, are that Alice kind of represents colonialism, because she goes into a foreign land and she's constantly trying to put her own cultural norms and values on these, you know, complete strangers. And that just causes nonstop problems with her. Another one, that it's Lewis Carroll's interpretation of what a young girl going through puberty would be like, because she never feels comfortable in her own clothes. She's either too big or she's too small, and she's constantly changing and can't make up her mind, and kind of just like nonstop illogical decisions. This was what he kind of perceived, like this, you know, budding female mind to maybe represent going through this time, which is another weird aspect of it. And then there's another, I guess the most obvious one, is that this was all about taking drugs and sort of hallucinations and altered states of consciousness, especially when you talk about his playing around with logic and words. That one's kind of a little bit more overt, and I think also a little bit more solidified by Jefferson Airplane. I think without that particular song, it might not have has had the strong implications of, oh yeah, if you see Alice in Wonderland, like LSD's involved.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, it had just been synthesized several years before and was not on the market. I don't know, maybe it was on the market by now, but obviously it wouldn't have affected the book. You'd need some ergot or something for that. I was thinking with Puberty Edge, and this is just in, I don't remember if this is in the book or not, but when she's at her largest size, you know, insisting that she's just a little girl, that certainly hits that button pretty hard.
I think it's an interesting take. I had never heard that one before, and it makes sense. And then there's another, this was an avenue that came from, like, I want to say, like, I'm not going to divide everyone into apologists and non-apologists, but essentially the people that seem to apologize the most for Carroll also tended to be the ones that suggested he might have been a Rosicrucian or a Freemason. And most of the articles and references I found there were actually Rosicrucians and Freemasons trying to claim this popular, you know, timeless author as one of their own. It's like, hey, look at one of these guys that's in our cool club. So they also happen to be apologists of like, oh no, it was normal for the time, you know. But there was a very interesting line here that a lot of his writings dealt with Rosicrucian sort of mentality. Like one of the ones that seemed a little bit vague, but when she gets really big, she can't see the golden key, or she's ignoring the golden key. because her ego, like if the size of it relates to her ego. So when the ego is so big, you can't see important information, or you're just ignorant of important information because your ego is taken over. And when she shrinks down, this is like the death of the ego. Now the only thing she can focus on is that golden key that's up above her, because it's like so big and it's, you know, it's like her focal point. And each time, like, she forgets when she gets too small, you know, when she's big enough to pick it up, she's ignorant of it. So she takes the pill and she shrinks down. So that was an interesting aspect of it, because of the use of like that golden key, and also the painting of the roses towards the end with the Rosicrucians. And the Freemason link was less direct. I was hoping to find more juicy dirt on this one, but the only Freemason link was just some speculation that after Lewis Carroll died, I think like 2/3 of his personal diaries just disappeared and were never recovered. And apparently that is very common for Freemasons, that, you know, the brothers, the lodge would go in and kind of take away your diaries. But there's a long list of other reasons based on some of the other stuff we just talked about, which people might have wanted to get rid of some of his older stuff, or maybe he did, you know, maybe he had like a dead man switch. It's like, hey, hey, buddy, man, if, you know, if I die, like, go and get rid of all my weird porn or something. So there might have been some kind of an agreement like that where it wiped out all of his diaries. But anyway, yeah. I found all that really interesting.
Yeah, we thought we knew the inappropriate photos, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, imagine the ones that never surfaced, right? Because the one that I think is the biggest smoking gun was actually found at a art gallery in France. So it's not like any of it was like hidden or found behind, you know, like an old false wall. Like, these were in art galleries.
I always like to throw out when we have these horrible things coming out. Were you familiar with Leonard Nimoy's photographic career?
No.
This is wild. Apparently from the 70s to about the time he died, he was into doing nudes of very large women. I'm like, cool.
Like an R. Crumb style?
Oh, I don't think it was. No, I think he was trying to go glam. He liked large women. Some people do. It's great. So that good one, I'm like, man. Okay. Yeah,
I know about that. That's cool.
It's certainly, certainly better than the Carroll approach in that case. The other music one, of course, yeah, the Jefferson Airplane, White Rabbit. But I feel like at least the flow of the language is more like a John Lennon thing, you know, with I Am the Walrus and Strawberry Fields Forever, kind of having a bit of a Carol snap to the words, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the Walrus, you know, Cuckoo Cuckoo and everything. I always thought that was interesting, although even on rewatching it and rereading some of the original, that the Walrus story that Tweedledum and Tweedledee tell is such a weird, like, it feels like it didn't need to be included in the movie. It's such a weird, like, out of left field thing, and I've really struggled with trying to find sort of the interpretations for it. I mean, I found a handful that were interesting to it, but that specific tale about the walrus and the carpenter and the oysters was just such a weird diversion in that movie. I'm curious to hear your take on it.
I think I've maybe stumbled over one of the interpretations you've got, where it's kind of like this weird capitalist thing with the walrus sort of being the industrialist, and, you know, trying to pull the wool over his customer's eyes, that sort of thing.
Well, one of the interesting ones that I found too was that the walrus is Peter and that the carpenter is Jesus, for obvious reasons. And that the oysters were the disciples. Although once I started reading into, like, okay, why is it Peter and Jesus? It breaks down a little bit. It's more just like because there's a carpenter, because there was 12 oysters, I think, in the original book. But again, it's like, I understand the parable, right? I understand the message that they're telling. And it was essentially, I kind of, without trying to look into it, I sort of interpret as that capitalist sort of issue of, you know, here's the worker and he's getting taken advantage of by the capitalist, and the oysters are essentially, you know, the worst part of the deal. Like, they just get eaten.
Right.
But I mean, again, like, why was that in Alice in Wonderland? Why was, out of all of the things that Disney could have selected to animate, why is that something that gets so much screen time?
Oh, I don't know. I heard your question the wrong way. So I'll first answer the right way, where maybe because it's an existing book, this movie does gel more. It's not kind of marking time as much as like we mentioned a few of the other ones, kind of like stitching things together because it's a new medium, basically. But like I do know that the Walrus and the Carpenter tends to be taken out of this movie a lot and shown in other places. Didn't Pixar even like borrow the sun and moon from it for a short a few years back, I think?
I'm not familiar with that one, if they did.
Yeah, I think they took that day and night imagery and did like a whole nother like short out of it. So the other one I was thinking of is I kind of buy into the capitalist interpretation because there were so many children's books that were obsessed with economics around this time period, right? You got, you know, the Time Machine has sort of the whole like socialist metaphor thing going on. And the Wizard of Oz, if you read them book form, is very economic thinking.
It's a fair point, although out of all of the companies at the time to be putting out anything pro-capitalist, I would think Disney would be the one putting out that message. So it was either, maybe it was just like a different of the times where even you could kind of have this sort of perspective and still be like an ultra-capitalist, like I guess Disney was. Or maybe it was a matter of the writers and the animators kind of having more direction because, you know, he was being pulled in a million other projects at the time too. So I don't know. And I agree that this thing could be kind of taken out of Alice and just watched on its own and stand up on its own 2 feet and kind of, you know, like the characters established, everything. None of it really comes back into the book or the movie that I'm aware of. I'm so fascinated, like why did they go on this tangent? Not just Lewis Carroll, but why did Disney go off on this tangent?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, the books do it like over and over. It's not, I mean, there's, again, Tweedledee and Tweedledum are just an episode in there, right? I mean, I guess there's just an episode in here. It's still a pretty, you know, modular sort of story. You could like reorder some of the stuff
and their only purpose in the cartoon is essentially to tell the story. So if you got rid of this story, then you really don't have any reason for Tweedledee and Tweedledum to exist either.
And again, they're not actually in the first book. So yeah, I guess you can reshuffle both books to a certain extent, which is what they're doing. I was thinking the watching it last night, the only place where I definitely will go, oh, 2010 is better, is Alan Rickman's the only person who should be doing the Caterpillar's voice.
I don't know, man. I might disagree with you a little bit on that one.
Yeah, sure.
I think I love his voice, and I loved, because I think he did multiple voices in that movie. It wasn't just the Caterpillar, but the Caterpillar, I actually made a couple. I have a note right here that says the Caterpillar kind of sucks. That it was my favorite character in the cartoon, but in the 2010 movie, it was just kind of not that interesting.
Okay, I'll give what he does is a lot better in this one. I just was like, I was like superimposing Alan Rickman's voice when I was watching it last night. This is like, I like that better. I feel like the Caterpillar needs to have that like, not proletarian. I'm thinking of all the lower class words, plebeian, not that. Patrician disdain. There we go.
Well, I like to have it. Because some of the notes that I, because I watched the cartoon and then I watched the movie, and I mentioned I also watched some of like the foreign kind of like more abstract movies, but I'm not going to get into those ones. The 2010 movie, it was, I was wondering like, why is it so gloomy and dark? Because I feel like I preferred that lighter, cartoony 1954s optimistic version of everything. Because it was, you know, like this childlike wonder into this crazy world, whereas the movie is like, you know, if you watch it in the time period 2010, it's just like that angsty teen just, you know, came out of college and is just like everything is about like criticizing the rest of the world, right? Like everything sucks and society sucks and everything is just a critique on something, and it kind of follows that. But also you realize it's directed by Tim Burton on top of this, so it already has like this gloomy sort of depressing look to it. But I found myself wishing that had more of the tongue-in-cheek sort of optimism of like Edward Scissorhands, you know, like some of like the really like punchy, poppy sort of stuff where like the people that are optimistic are like over the top and doing it amongst all this crazy stuff going on. Whereas this one, it was a little bit more on the nose of like, everyone knows that the whole world is kind of miserable and they're making their best to get through it. And I don't know, it felt like a weird dynamic that the movie could have been better without that. But I mean, you know, I'm freaking sitting here talking on a podcast about it, not a movie director, but it really did feel like it was just a little bit too much Burton.
Yeah, well, also keep in mind the 2010 one makes that weird conceit of being like, oh, we're a sequel. Like, technically, that's a sequel to this animated film, right?
And it felt really tacked on because
10 years later.
And everyone remembers her, but she doesn't remember it, except she remembers that she had a dream that was like this. But even though she's reliving the dream, like, beat for beat, she never puts it together that, mm-hmm. like, oh, this is the same thing. It's such a weird, because I think for the first half of that movie, everyone's like, you're Alice. And she's like, no, I'm not Alice. And then she starts convincing other people that she's not the same Alice. And it felt like it was just kind of tacked on. Like, and I remember a few times looking down at the time, because I think the Disney cartoon one was about like a minute or an hour and 10 minutes or something like that runtime. And I think the movie was like a half hour longer than that. And man, you could have easily taken that half hour back out. And I went on a whole rabbit hole of like, when did movies become longer? And apparently it was like right at that cusp of like the 30s and 40s. It was a little bit normal to have a shorter movie. And then as time went on, it gets closer and closer to that 2 hour mark and then starts weaning back over.
Yeah, the late 50s, early 60s certainly beat people over the head, you know, because you got stuff like Ben-Hur, Spartacus, It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World, and which are like just movies that last forever. And then I think the thing now is that there's kind of like push and pull with the theaters in 2022. I don't know if it's still the case because people stream, but you know, it's like, well, a 2.5 hour prestige film, you can only show it like 4 times a day. Whereas if we want to get into 30s lengths, a 70-minute movie, you can have like 3 more showings and make that much more money. So
yeah, I think
maybe the fact that people are watching it. I'm just saying, at home, you want bang for your buck. So it's like, oh, I'm going to rent that 2.5 hour movie. It feels like I'm getting more.
Well, that director's cut with all of the extra stuff that nobody wanted to see. And now you get to see it and pay a little bit extra for it.
Yeah. And
that rabbit hole was interesting because it did really come down to like an agreement between the movie producers associations and the theater owners of like, hey, let's just kind of aim for about 90 minutes. It's a nice kind of medium ground of people feel like they got their value out of it, but also you can keep them churning and getting, you know, more butts in the seats.
I think that's that 90 seems like a pretty perfect length. I mean, you know, and when it's the night before I got to do a podcast, I'm like, hey, an hour 10, that's great. Right.
So. Honestly, I'm sold on like the hour and 10 minute format. I want to actually start looking for movies that are specifically a little bit less than 90 minutes. Cause I do feel like there's like a perfect length in there for the right type of movie, for that, like, you know, that big epic coming of age adventure. I think you might need that two hour movie.
Oh yeah, if you're, you know, gonna get into like old school sci-fi potboilers and westerns, you know, like that's the perfect length, and it's all on YouTube. So I say I do the sci-fi podcast, and the one I was actually rendering when we started the call is, we were like, my co-host was just like, find something mad from the 50s. I'm like, okay. So it's one of our more random choices there, but
no shortage.
There is this. Sure. I do want to get, you know, of course I do want to make the focus the animated one, but there is a sequel, the Looking Glass sequel to the 2010, which I only saw once. I saw the 2010 movie many times because my daughter really liked it when she was 3 for some reason. We saw The Looking Glass once, which is way more colorful, but it's just like completely incoherent. Like, I can't even remember what like the semblance of a story was supposed to be for that.
Really? Was this also Johnny Depp?
Yeah. Different director, I think. Yeah, exactly. It's like, this is, it's like a memory hold movie almost, right?
I had no idea that even exists. Even when I was looking up all the movies, it didn't come up. I'll have to look deeper.
Maybe because the title is not Alice in Wonderland. I'm actually bringing up the little info on this because I feel like it actually made money and then was completely forgotten about. Yeah, maybe just like nobody could reiterate the story. Sorry, I only typed Looking Glass and I'm getting a band. Okay. 2016. And man, yeah.
There were so many weird little facets of the 2010. So I think I actually took more notes in 2010 just because it was so much weirder than the cartoon version. Maybe just because the cartoon version is sort of the baseline. You know, like even the weirdest aspects of that movie, the Disney cartoon, didn't seem that abstract. Like if you compared it to Fantasia, you compared it to Dumbo, it was well animated, but it wasn't so abstract where there was any particular scene was like, man, this is blowing my mind, like the dancing elephants or something, you know, or like the sound waves coming together.
I think they were going for that with the breakdown of reality at the end. Like I said, I think they reused with the animatics from the
Doors floating and like it starts out, she like almost jumps into like water, but then the water becomes completely transparent and it turns into like a red fog. And then the fog's sort of like bouncing around this big ethereal abstract, you know, like universe. And then she goes back through the door and she's back in reality again. Although, like, I don't think any of it really, like, knocked my socks off the same way that some of those scenes from Dumbo and Fantasia really did.
That is true. Well, the 2016 movie, it had a budget of $170 million, which is pretty insane even now. And it made $300 million, or almost $300 million. I'm like, and nobody remembers it exists. That's amazing. But yeah, I saw it the one time. I'm looking at the plot here and I'm like, I don't remember even seeing this. I kind of do. Oh, yeah, it was just sad.
It was Alan Rickman's last movie too.
Oh, ouch. Okay. But yeah, it's not Burton. That was probably, I mean, did I say this on a podcast? I had this ridiculous dream a few months ago and one part of it was, I think I did say on a podcast, but not this one. But yeah, part of the dream was me like helping a really falling over drunk Tim Burton across the town square. And then he vomits on my shirt and I'm trying to figure out how to get Tim Burton's vomit off my shirt. And my friend, when I'm telling him that dream, is like, oh, well, that was just your subconscious critiquing the last 10 years of his film career. I'm like, I don't think my subconscious is that snitty a film critic, but hey, you could be right. I don't know why I had that dream, but adjacent to Wonderland. If you notice an
ongoing series of directors vomiting on you, then you might be onto something.
Yeah, it keeps happening. Yeah, okay, but yeah, that's kind of his pivot point, I think, where we just kind of gave up on Tim Burton for the most part. Maybe made something decent recently.
So, are you talking about the 2010 movie was sort of your pivot point?
Yeah, because he'd done the Chocolate Factory, not as good as the one with Gene Wilder, I would say, but you know, not bad, I guess. But then
I think it's almost sacrilege to even mention the Tim Burton remake or Johnny Depp and Gene Wilder's version in the same sentence, man.
I can kind of get that. I just will say the one thing I do really like in the Burton remake of that is the malfunctioning singing animatronics that all catch on fire.
Oh, it had a lot of great merit, man. I loved it. I just kind of, I don't know. And also in this one too, and I kind of love Johnny Depp, but man, I did not like him as the Mad Hatter in this movie. And I didn't like him as Charlie, but I think the Charlie one is a little bit unfair just because Gene Wilder couldn't get any better. Like you couldn't have cast a better better performance out of anyone. So like no one's ever going to beat that particular. And since he's the main focus of that movie, even if he's not the protagonist, like that movie, you know, and Gene Wilder inseparable. Whereas Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I wish they could have just like put Gene Wilder in that, like just CG him in and CG Johnny Depp back out, and it might actually be a really good movie again.
Or like Rogue One style. Well, the other crime for that one was neutering the boat ride, which is one of the best pieces of film ever in the Wilder one, and they just kind of like gloss over in the new one. So I guess Johnny Depp can get creepy, but maybe not that creepy. I don't know. At least not on screen. I don't know. let's. I don't know, maybe bit by bit, a bit more on the 50s one. Let's look at the magic in this one. Is it I guess Rosicrucian is not really magic stuff. Where are we getting the magic stuff?
No, absolutely.
Golden Dawn, Golden Keys.
So Rosicrucianism kind of predates a lot of the more modern ones. And Rosicrucianism was sort of an amalgamation of all the different mystical and occult practices from many different kind of cultures and paganism and stuff, and like all moshed together. It really was like the junk drawer / grab bag of just like everything you can imagine. Sort of like Hellenistic thought merged with a little bit more modern interpretations of it. So Rosicrucianism was like anything occult that you could think of, although it was also relegated to sort of like the rich and fancy people, which happened to be Lewis Carroll's kind of running class, specifically being at Oxford and everything. And I believe he, the school that he taught at, Christ Church, that's actually where the Harry Potter big like famous scene where they go and like they sit down and they eat in the big cafeteria, that's Christ Church. So that's the place where Lewis Carroll was actually teaching. So, you know, like that whole realm of like Harry Potter Victorian-esque, you know, like magical architecture and everything, like that was his legit real life. You know what I mean? Like he was living in the Harry Potter cafeteria as he's coming up with these ideas and stuff. And then the Rosicrucian link, aside from just the sort of the clans that he ran in and the fact that he was in the right type of, you know, class of society and knew the right people to have been in that, there's not enough record on that. However, another really cool aspect of this is that Alice in Wonderland is essentially a story about a girl that goes underground. The original title was Alice Goes Underground or something. And there's a story of Persephone, which is a story about a girl that goes underground in Hades. And Persephone is sometimes represented by a white rabbit, or, you know, the story kind of embodies sort of rabbits in within it. And this tie between this white rabbit of Alice in Wonderland, Persephone, and the fact that Lewis Carroll was also a practical magician, not like Rosicrucian style magician, but he also like legitimately just liked doing sleight of hand tricks and pulling white rabbits out of hats sort of was like the going. That wasn't like a novelty at that point. Like people kind of knew about the rabbits and hats. So those three kind of links together, you've got practical stage magic, you've got actual like Rosicrucianism, occultism style magic kind of tied into this white rabbit symbolism. And I think that even if he wasn't a Rosicrucian, he probably would have known about some of those aspects of it as he kind of created it.
You know, I'm actually having a bit of a look at the Lewis Carroll wiki. I was thinking about the Golden Dawn. I guess that was a little after his time.
Yeah, Golden Dawn started with Mathers.
Yeah, about 1890, I guess. So yeah, I guess Lewis Carroll would have been a little maybe old to get into that one.
Yeah, Rosicrucianism started, and then the Golden Dawn was sort of like I'm not gonna say the common man, because you still had to be in like a certain class to even have the leisure time to pursue these like loftier ideas, right? But the Golden Dawn kind of brought it a little bit more structure, but also a little bit more approachable for more people outside of kind of like the higher echelon of golden. Because when you talk about Rosicrucianism, I mean, you're literally talking about like the top professors at Oxford style schools. Again, Lewis Carroll and like his dean and sort of his peer group, but not a lot of people outside of, you know, if you couldn't have like the Kevin Bacon more like less than 6 degrees, you'd almost have to be like 2 or 3 degrees away from some kind of regal or, you know, nobility in order to get into Rosicrucianism.
Yeah, I was accidentally read another Crowley biography.
Actually, oops. You just kind of slipped it down. Yeah, read 600 pages.
That's actually exactly what happened, because it's the one that the Pretenders first bass player wrote. I think his name's Gary Lockman or something. But yeah, I got the book, and I thought it was going to be like Crowley's influence on pop culture and stuff. Which that was the last chapter, but all in all, it's just another Crowley biography. But oh well.
I actually I've got one behind me too, like a 800 pager. It's called Crowley in America, and it's just about the years that he came. And I didn't even realize that he had come to America. So I'm excited to read that. But
oh yeah, people thinking he was a double agent or whatever. One of the problems, I'll put that in quotations, but I do most of my reading on my tablet now, my iPad. So I often don't know how long the books I'm reading are. I've had a few times when I actually had an author on a podcast and I was like, hold up your book for me. I want to see how thick it actually is. Because I read it on a tablet, right?
Yep.
I was like, well, you kill someone books. With that book. Yeah, you kill somebody with that. So I think that's fun for the author. Anyway, it's like I did bother to read your book. I probably even bought it, but yeah, I just want to see how thick it is.
And sometimes it just it sucks when you're trying to cite a specific page because your page is different than everyone else's page, depending on your font size and everything else.
Right. As far as Alice in Wonderland, though, that is one where I think it's downstairs now, or there's just one randomly around, you know, just in the house. And occasionally I pick it up and read a few pages. And I've been doing that for years. I haven't like actually just read the book for a while, but I might actually open and just go to straight to the Walrus and the Carpenter, right? Maybe that's why some of these things are there, because it's not like most novels where you really do need to start it, work your way. You can kind of just like plonk anywhere into both of the books. So
that's a fair point. And there's also a lot of places in the book that you can read it without even caring about the storytelling or the adventure and the protagonist. And it's literally just about like logic puzzles and just magical thinking and interesting ways of new perspectives and kind of like changing the way that your mind almost works. Which I hope we'll get into a little bit, the MK Ultra CIA.
Oh yeah, sure. the flow of the words, I think, I mean, again, if he's a mathematician and a magician, he's probably thinking about how that, you know, he's casting a spell by writing. Yeah. So literally, he's spelling the words.
And some of the lines that are present in both movies and that are cited very often, like the Jabberwocky and a lot of the instances of like a cacophony. So, you know, the concept of cacophony is it's just a bunch of words that you put together, or it's syllables within a word that don't sound like they should go together. And it's almost like an assault on your eardrums. Like it's almost not the exact opposite, but like alliterations. Like alliterations are so nice to hear, you know, Best Buy and TikTok and like things that kind of like roll off the tongue. Like a cacophony is the exact opposite of something that would roll off the tongue. And a lot of that semantics and a lot of the grammar that comes out of like the Jabberwocky tale, this is like intentionally written to just be cacophony after cacophony, so that like every single line, it sounds like someone's like attacking you with just like harsh words over and over again. And that evokes the feeling that it's meant to evoke, which I think is not just being masterful of language, but I think there was probably some level of, you know, that genius aspect of like, this guy's a crazy, you know, ultra horrible villain because like in his free time he's doing very inappropriate things, but then like in his other free time he's writing crazy, you know, math formulas and translating essentially math and logic into stories in ways that I don't think anyone's still been able to do the same way, which is why these stories are so timeless. It's kind of like, despite the author, they are, you know, they have like the staying power.
Yeah, sometimes when you hear about how, I mean, there's a certain line of horrible words you don't want to even think about. But in general, I'm like, oh, this person's a horrible prick. It comes down to why I don't have to deal with him in my kitchen, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I'm going to have to deal with, you know, William Shatner, like trying to play practical jokes on me in real life so I can just enjoy Star Trek, you know?
It helps too if the dirt doesn't get dug up for like over a century after your works have been sort of, you know, assimilated into multiple cultures. Because I think in addition to the Bible and Shakespeare, Alice in Wonderland is one of the first books to have been translated into so many different languages and sold so many different copies so quickly.
Yeah, that's why I kind of jumped towards, you know, Shatner for my celebrity that seems unpleasant, because it sounds like he's just a prick and then laughs at you. So not quite as bad as a Spacey, although I do find a great conversation starter is, what is your favorite Kevin Spacey movie? So alliteration wise, I'm just going to shout out, because I was giggling about yesterday, I was talking with friends about like you write a fantastic book and then just give it like the worst character names ever. So my gold standard for there, which is a little Carol Jason, was what was it? Oh, Tuck Fard. Yeah, that was my lead character's name. Tuck Fard. Yeah. Just wrong in like multiple ways. So I like that. Yeah, my ear, let's change course a little bit. My ears perked up when we were going to go CIA and MK Ultra. And of course I've heard that kind of tied in with this film before and all that. Although is this a little early to be too direct with that? I mean, it's 1950. I guess we are CIA. We're not OSS anymore, but I feel like the tendrils would have been tentative at this point.
You are correct. I do think that it might be, for the Disney cartoon movie, it might have been a little bit early to have a direct CIA MK Ultra specific correlation. Although as you kind of already mentioned, without the Disney cartoon, this still has the same amount of staying power. It still is like the number three best-selling book of all time. It still has the most amount of English words that we use from like this like a literary source, I think, outside of Shakespeare. I think another one, ironically, has to do with John Dee. I think John Dee also contributed like the most amount of frequently used English words, the language. John Dee being the Queen's magician, essentially, the original 007. But anyways, I think that it's a little bit too early for the Disney movie and MK Ultra be directly related, but it's definitely not too early for this, you know, CIA MK Ultra mind control sort of tactics to be based on the original Alice in Wonderland and the original concepts of taking this mathematical logic and bringing it into essentially interrogation techniques. And there's some concrete evidence of this one. So this one is actually a little bit more fun to explore, because there was a CIA interrogation manual called Kubark. And I think Kubark itself was some sort of cryptic anagram that translates back into CIA somehow. And Kubark was released sometime in like 2006, I believe. They actually published it online. You can find the original copies, but it was originally released in July of 1963, so about 10 years after the cartoon came out. And I don't know if the interrogation techniques were based on the movie. I assume it was still based on the book, but of course, with the movie being popular, it would have been impossible to not separate the two. But within this, so if you look this up, if you find page 76 of the Kubark Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual, and the subtext is essentially, it's a torture guide, tells you how to torture somebody. And which is interesting, because on the very first pages, as the Kubark manual opens up, it explicitly says like, this is not to be used in any sort of coercion. You're not supposed to imply any sort of like pain's going to be inflicted on someone. You're not supposed to imply that they're going to be under any kind of physical harm. But then as you actually read the techniques, it's like, oh, and like, you do this for like a month or something, you know, and they're talking about like sleep deprivation and keeping you from eating and like things that would obviously be considered torture, I think, especially mm-hmm. for months on end. But at the very beginning, it's like, oh, but none of this should be under coercion. And they cite because of previous operations that had been compromised. But anyways, page 76, there's an interrogation tactic that they call the Alice in Wonderland tactic, also known as the confusion technique. And what it basically does is it uses the absolute absence of logic on the person that you're interrogating. So some of the examples that they give, and I'm going to paraphrase and throw some of these out there, but if you're being sort of argumentative within interrogation, you're not being helpful, sometimes they'll reward you when you're not helpful. And then when you are helpful, they'll cold you out or they'll yell at you. So if they're like asking you questions and you're like, you know, screw off, coppers, whatever, it'll be like, hey, you want to smoke? You know, they'll start being nice to you. And the second you actually cooperate and give them the information they're looking for, they act like you're lying to them and they do it intentionally. And they also start doing weird stuff like they'll feed you your breakfast, and then 10 minutes later, they'll feed you lunch. And then 10 hours later, they'll feed you dinner. And then 10 minutes later after that, they'll feed you breakfast again. And it just like makes no sense. And it's intentionally meant to completely throw you off. They mentioned changing the clocks. So if they leave, you know, they have you leave an interrogation room, they'll set the clock back 4 hours and put you back in there and make you think that you're crazy for thinking that you lost time or that the time was off. It's just nonstop gaslighting, and it goes on for hours, days, weeks, months, however long it basically needs to take. And the summary is that this causes any rational person struggles to maintain some kind of structure and sense, no matter, you know, how crazy you think you are, or like how creative or how mentally stable. If you're subjected to this kind of just nonstop absence of logic for weeks or months on end, especially when it's authority figures, you're in a controlled environment where they're controlling your sleep patterns, your food intake, just everything, like every part of you is being controlled. And then you add in this extra level of like, you can't have any sort of structure to base your life around. It just says like reality for this person just starts to disintegrate to the point where they'll just tell you everything on their mind constantly, not because they're now trying to get out of it, but because they're trying to now make sense of the world and just reality itself. And reading how like far and all the, like the specific techniques that they get into, it was like mind blowing. And it was kind of cool that they called this the Alice in Wonderland tactic, because again, it was almost a reference to how Alice in Wonderland and the logic puzzles that Lewis Carroll sort of injected into it. And it feels like Lewis Carroll, again, might have been onto something here, where he found like a secret cheat code, you know, like the blood code, the Konami code for like
you reality. Know,
the human, yeah, dude, like, I mean, not like reality itself, but the human perception of it. He found that Konami code to like get, you know, into the admin menu almost.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, our perception of time, because that test takes forever. And, I know sometimes I do a meditation at lunchtime, and sometimes there's been a few times like, oh crap, it's 5 hours later. I missed like 3 hours of work. I'm like, oh no, it timed out exactly where we're supposed to. So it's amazing. I'm just sitting here thinking of, I mean, I like to play mind games on people, not particularly, you know, like nefarious ones, but, yeah, one of my worst nonsense moments was, I don't know why, when I was in university, I just decided to do a Buster and Keaton impression for like an hour when hanging out with my girlfriend, but I didn't tell her I was doing that, so she didn't like that.
I mean, the whole trick is just how long you can hold on to it and not break character, essentially.
We were playing squash, the university gym, so I just had to run around hitting the ball with a stone face, right?
And another, I was going to say another weird tangent that I went down on this, and I'm still not sure if I'm right, but there was a certain scene in the 2010 movie that I could have sworn I saw the queen, and the white queen has like this gaggle of other princesses or something that are like hanging out with her. And one of those was the chick from Westworld, Rachel Wood something. I can't remember her full name. And I think at the time she was the girlfriend of Marilyn Manson, and Marilyn Manson was actually putting together a Alice in Wonderland / Lewis Carroll movie / documentary at this exact time. So, and she was going to be in it. So there was actually a crossover between Disney's Alice in Wonderland and Marilyn Manson's Alice in Wonderland sharing one of the same actresses, but she, I think Evan Rachel Wood, I think she ended up being uncredited in the 2010 movie. And it was a rabbit hole that I wasn't willing to spend much more time on, but it felt like a cool, another extra tangent, because I didn't even realize Marilyn Manson had been working on a Lewis Carroll / Alice in Wonderland movie.
That is interesting. And maybe that has to do a little bit with the use of this and kind of since 1950 and sort of like espionage or mind trickery or all that stuff, because partly because of that movie, but yeah, there does seem to be like a weird goth overlay that's just been thrown on it, with 2010 solidifying that. But even before, well, I mean,
the Victorian era, so that's like it. Victorian anything attracts goths like freaking moths to a flame, right? Then you've got lots of like blood imagery, even in the cartoon, a lot of off with the head and the red paint, sort of representing the red blood dripping down. Like you wouldn't necessarily see a lot of off with their head and blood imagery in a modern Disney movie. And then also in the original book and in the 2010 remake, there's a scene where they take out the Bandersnatch's eye with like a little sword. They literally rip it out of his head. So like there is a lot of sort of like, I think out of the Tim Burton adaptation and the cartoon, Tim Burton feels like it might have been a little bit more accurate towards what Lewis Carroll actually had in his mind as he was like writing the stuff out and drawing it out. Because again, his original artwork didn't make the cut for publication because it was too depressing and sort of like somber looking and creepy, I think was the between the lines there.
Yeah, now I'm kind of sitting here thinking about how this, like, I think between book, movie, and all of it, obviously it's programmed all of our minds like a little bit, because I don't remember the first time I saw this, you know, or came across the story or whatever. I probably came across in like little bits and pieces, and before I even saw the whole thing, you know, again, maybe just seeing the walrus and the carpenter out of context somewhere as a, you know, 3 year old or something.
I mean, if you were to ask someone to name, you know, a few children's books off the top of their head, this one's going to be in most people's list right off the bat, just because, again, it's, I didn't realize how freaking popular it was. When you're competing with the Bible, you're pretty freaking big. You know what I mean?
No, you've used the term rabbit hole multiple times, and yeah. And today I'm confused with what you mean by that. I'm like, does he mean the one in this movie or just the term in general? So yeah. And with words that we use, I was just wondering how high Orwell is on that list, because that's usually the person I think of for, like, you know, the book that has words we use in normal speak now, right?
maybe, although I think his a little bit more on the nose, like his, a lot of like the double think and double speak and sort of the terms that he came up with, I think are used in very specific contexts, whereas Alice in Wonderland and rabbit hole stuff and Through Looking Glass and just I think specific quotes from the book itself are just more applicable in general, you know, situations, versus Orwell, you're already in a very specific niche of conversation when you bring up double think and stuff like that.
That's true. Yeah.
Good, you know.
Well, again, I guess Alice is so ubiquitous that you don't even notice anymore, right? Like, if someone was super nuts, they could go back through his podcast, see how many times we said rabbit hole, and see how many times it was used as a euphemism or how many times we were literally talking about it. I think it's more euphemism in this case.
I mean, Off With Their Heads essentially was an Alice in Wonderland thing, and most of the uses of Off With Their Heads is a derives from the Alice in Wonderland's version of it.
Pointless rage, right? You know, curiouser and curiouser regularly shows up here and there. So, and following your white rabbit, chasing the dragon. Chasing the dragon's not in this, but following the white rabbit is, of course.
And I think one of my favorite quotes from this one is the whole, like, I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. Probably my favorite quote of the book / movies, but also such a great representation of that magical thinking. Because imagine like a Victorian era typical person is not thinking of 6 impossible things before breakfast. It's essentially like, you know, thinking like a child and exploring, having just like crazy, creative, daydreamy sort of absence of logic, you know, thoughts. And to force yourself to do that constantly puts you into this magical thinking mode. Man, there's so many cool little elements of that. Like, even in the book, and I think in the 2010 movie, when she's about to go into Wonderland, and she's the dad's telling her, as she's like a little girl still, if you ever go back into that Wonderland, here's a way that you can tell if you're dreaming, and he like pinches her or something. And it's essentially explaining how you do lucid dreaming, or even like NLP, which would be like an anchor, like this kinesthetic anchor, which you can tell. And in doing lucid dreaming techniques, one of those techniques is doing these reality checks. And one of the reality checks is pinching yourself. Usually it's, you know, somewhere on your hand or something, but you know that if you do it often enough in reality, you understand what it feels like. So then when you go to do it in a dream and you pinch yourself, if it doesn't feel exactly like you're used to in reality, and that pinch lets you know that you're currently in a dream state, and that you can then like start to take either control over it and get into a lucid dream, or snap out of it, which is what they're kind of telling Alice to do. But I mean, this seems like such an innocuous little thing, like, oh, it's the dad telling the daughter, you know, pinch yourself in your dream. We've all heard that before. But within the context of traveling through different mental states and magical thinking, I think it takes on a lot different context, and it's a little bit more important about that anchoring of like, here's how you can control these lucid dreams you're about to go on.
Yeah, I would, I guess I would promote the jump method there. Just when you think about it, take a little jump. And if you start floating or flying, it's a dream. And it worked once because I was sure it wasn't a dream. And I was like, oh, crap, I'm floating. Okay.
So I mean, that's what those reality checks are all for, man. That's 100% what they're there for, is you do something that it would just be so, like, you know what the outcome is, and it's such a boring, predictable outcome. So then when it doesn't have that boring, predictable outcome, it's obvious that you're now in a dream state.
The other thing, and I guess there's a lot of things with the white rabbit's obsessiveness about being late. There's all the animals, the birds and such, in their weird ritual circle dance thing or whatever. But I was thinking about in dreams, but more so in that like waking twilight. I think a lot of us do this. I don't know if it's a weird thing for me or not, but just getting your brain locked into weird repetitive tasks that don't make any sense. Like, you know, I need to move my leg up my other leg and then back down to achieve this goal, and the goal doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I just feel like that's kind of something that might apply to this movie, and thinking of some of the Wonderland Diazin's weird obsessiveness.
Well, and it's not just that this Wonderland has no logic. It's that the logic just doesn't coalesce with the logic in the waking world. Like, and I think like the unbirthday is kind of a cool concept, because it's like, unless it's your birthday, it's going to be your unbirthday. And everyone celebrates your unbirthday, which would literally be every single day except for one day of the year. But it's like, it's such a common occurrence. And it doesn't make any sense for you to celebrate that. That one, I think, is the most easy to understand, because it doesn't take any like real abstract thinking. It's any child has understood the concept of opposite day before. And that's sort of what like the unbirthday is, like this opposite day in thinking. But man, that's like the gateway drug into Lewis Carroll's like absolute, again, I guess not absence of logic, but like the inversion of logic.
Well, I just use the unbirthday yesterday. You know, I teach kids, 5-year kids turn in 6 the next day. So the front manager's like, oh, we need to sing happy birthday. So we do that. And then one of the other kids is about to start crying because it's not their birthday. So I brought out the unbirthday.
That's awesome.
A 5-year old, that's pure magic, you know?
did you do that specifically because you had watched Alice in Wonderland recently?
I would have done it anyway. I mean, yeah. I was in the middle of the movie, but I would have, yeah, I didn't need to watch the movie again to use that particular tool. I think it's not the first time I've had to play that card. So,
well, next time, if you want to use it, another real world scenario, maybe you can figure out a way to use that Alice in Wonderland interrogation tactics on your kids.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I probably have already, but not quite to the extremes you were describing, of course, but yeah. I know what like one magic. Well, one, when I, this is where the kid's line for magic is, and maybe that's worth considering with Alice, since she is relatively young. I think she's a little older in the movie than in the book, if I'm correct.
Big time, actually. In the book, she's supposed to be 9, and I think the girl at the time was about 10 or 11 years old. But in the book, she's between 7 and 9, and in the movie, they state that she's 19 because she's about to turn 20. So she's like well out of, you know, school and everything. She's been just kind of moping around the house for at least 4 or 5 years. But
that's the 2010 movie though, right?
The 2010 movie, yeah. She's 19. Okay,
so we can assume she's probably
about 7. But I think that in the cartoon, she's a little bit more lucid than a 7-year-old. She's probably closer to about 12 if you had to put a number on it.
That's what I was thinking, but especially the 7-year-old would perceive magic very differently, because getting back with the kids, if I pull out a deck of cards and just do a shuffle, you know, they think that's magic. And then if I do the one card magic trick I actually know, you know, I just shattered their mind. So like they'll start looking through the cards, you know, like, oh, give me those. Even for the shuffle, they think shuffling is magic, right? So probably because they can't do it.
What's the Arthur C. Clarke quote that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So, I mean, to a 7-year-old, you know, almost everything is sufficiently advanced technology, right?
Yet they can work a iPhone with no trouble.
Maybe. I don't know, man. Some of the recent reports are starting to look like they can use it as long as the apps are working the way that they expect. And then the second something goes wrong, you know, like this, the same sort of technical ignorance starts to set in. Like, I think it'll be interesting because I think everyone assumed that this whole digital native thing just kind of automatically happened. Like, if you just put your kid to sleep with his head on an iPad through osmosis, they'll understand, you know, how the operating system works at a deep level. But it turns out that that might not actually be the case. And now you see kids with like a printed book swiping the page, expecting it to turn.
You know? I have not seen that one quite yet. Yeah, like with my daughter, it's kind of like we threaded this weird needle where she didn't really. Maybe Japan's like a little bit. See, people think of Japan's like being super high tech, which there is a certain degree of that. But we also like still use fax machines, and you know, government offices are just now being like, "Gee, maybe we should stop using paper." You know, so there is weird ways. Like Japan's quite backwards as well. I mean, you especially for Enko, which is kind of like old school, you know, in like 50s, 60s, Kill Bill music, that sort of thing. You can still find cassette tape stores because there's a bunch of old fogies that are still playing them. Like new cassette tapes.
Cassette tapes are making a big comeback. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I knew they were for punk rock and experimental electronic music, but
oh no, it's across the board now, man.
Okay, that's cool. But yeah, I mean, they never went away in Japan if you were going to go listen to all this Enko music. So
I think too that, I mean, this I'm probably a little bit of ignorant speaking out of turn here, but I also think that like compared to the US or even Europe, Japan gets to live in a slightly smaller bubble where there's like maybe like the having to send a paper document from one office building to the other office building within business districts in Japan might actually still be somewhat efficient compared to having to send something from New York to California or something.
Yeah, that's part of it. But also just changing a policy is really annoying. That's why things change so slowly in Japan. So, you know, if we're still doing it the way we did in the 80s, whatever, it's too annoying to change.
It would blow my mind if I saw someone legitimately using a fax machine in like a modern company. I mean, I guess I've seen
it. Oh, before. I could probably find some. Just yesterday, now this was in a copier, but yeah, I had to take one out because I copied some stuff out for a class, and on the top was a fax. So I had to put back for the front folks. So yeah, it is weird, but yeah, the point being, you know, 2010 is when my daughter was a toddler, and I think the most we gave her was this really lame Cookie Monster game on Nintendo DS, but she didn't really start playing with, you know, phones and pads till she was at least 6, which I guess isn't really the case anymore.
Oh, I'm actually glad you brought up games here too, because I didn't have any great notes on this, but man, American McGee's Alice video game. Have you ever played it or heard of it before?
I have heard of it. Yeah, I think it was something that I was. What year did that come out? It's not particularly new, is it?
It must have been the early 2000s.
Yeah, I was thinking late 90s, but I do remember hearing about it. But if you want to rip on that a bit, maybe I don't know much.
Quarter of it or so, because I didn't have a great computer at the time when it came out, but honestly I almost feel like that had a better storyline and visuals than 2010 movie, and if anything I might try to go back and like replay that old American McGee's Alice and just pretend like that might have been another movie that was part of canon.
One other thing we definitely have to discuss with this movie though is Alice's substance abuse, keeping mushrooms in both her pockets, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, of course, eat me, drink me. There's a lot of that.
But there's a good point here she seems very experienced with it, because even as she comes up to that table for the first time, she kind of like says to herself and out loud, like, you know, some people, paraphrasing, like some people go overboard, but if you know how much or how little to take, that you can kind of control it. So like, she sounds like a very well-seasoned, it's like, you know, it's like the person like, oh yeah, you want a heroic dose? We're going to get you to like 4.3 dry grams of some Mexicana psilocybin. Like, she knows exactly what she's doing throughout a lot of this process, I think. Like, she's a very well-versed traveler. And she also doesn't lose her shit quite the way that you would expect someone to going through all this, which I think is one of those interesting aspects between the cartoon and the later movie, because as a 7-year-old or even as a 12-year-old, sort of like this changing and fluctuation of reality and nonsensical things feel like they would be more easily accepted than this 19-year-old going through the same stuff, because it really feels like you would be losing your mind at that point and starting to like deteriorate mentally versus being able to kind of roll with the punches and keep like a fluid mentality.
Yeah, 12-year-old Alice, I mean, she gets flustered for sure, but generally takes it all in stride. Where like you said, in 2010, she's spending half the movie trying to convince everyone she's not who they think she is or that she's someone else and all that. Where here, she kind of, in the 1950 version, and I guess the book, she rolls with the punches, you know, for the most part.
Well, that's kind of the cool part about her, I think, is that she rolls with the punches and keeps going on this adventure. Whereas like the 2010 version, I swear, it feels like that whole entire movie takes place at a funeral or something.
I actually, that is one thing, because when we did Cinderella, I was just like, yeah, I don't like Cinderella. She's, you know, well, my email title was Cinderella's a bit of a ditz, right? Where Alice is perfectly fine, you know.
I like Alice, bro. Alice is cool as hell.
Yeah, exactly. So, and even the 2010 version's reasonably cool, right? I mean,
she feels a little
hot topic,
but she feels a little bit mopey. She feels like she'd kind of be a drag to be around. The 2010 version,
she shops at Hot Topic. And, well, let's face it, I hung around those girls when I was 18, 19. So a few of them, at least. So, yeah, but it's still someone that's not unlikable. Whereas I didn't see, as I said, I did not see the live action Cinderella. So I don't know if they managed to give her a character in there, but I have my doubts. But Alice is always a character. Basically, I mean, if you give someone just such mad situations they have to deal with, they have to have some character. You don't have anything happening.
Yeah, fair enough. They would just zone out, I guess.
You're waiting for your prince to come. There's not much going on there.
That's a good point, too, here, in that at least the cartoon version, there's really no aspect of that at all. Like, she's not chasing after a prince or a love interest, because, again, 7 to 12-year-old girl doesn't really fit into that same element of like the princess and the prince and trying to figure out what to do with the life. Whereas the movie, that's almost exactly what the movie's about. It's about her getting married and hating, you know, rich people and privilege, even though she herself is like the epitome of rich people and privilege, because unlike Cinderella, like, she wasn't doing any kind of manual labor. Her only job was to essentially just like look cute in a dress, you know what I mean, and curtsy.
And the second live action movie, I think, begins with her, like, you know, with taking her own ship to China or something. Like, okay, that there's some privilege there.
There's nothing quite as Victorian as smuggling opium from China either, right?
That yeah. Was oh yeah.
How you kept that legacy going?
It goes in. No, in. Opium goes in, money comes out. I don't know how it worked. I forgot. I just know there were a few wars there.
You start looking into the original funding of almost every higher education institution, you find opium smuggling at the other side of it.
It's always weird when Alice tells the flowers she's a certain species and doesn't get it anywhere near correct. You think, I don't know, I feel like by that point I at least knew, you know, like the whole Homo erectus and all that sort of stuff, right?
I think it was just a bad joke in the movie.
Yeah. Something I did notice, I recently watched the film Annihilation, and I definitely was like thinking, yeah, these flowers are real similar to the weird like people flowers in Annihilation. I don't know if you saw that movie. The idea, kind of a disturbing Wonderland where all the DNA of everything is kind of being mixed together. But
it's never getting any bells. I'm almost positive I've seen it, but it went into that same black hole as the 2016 Alice movie.
That's a Natalie Portman where there's this big weird alien bubble thing on a lighthouse, and they go into explore, and time and space breaks down. It is kind of like a horror movie, Alice in Wonderland, when you think about it. So, or at least in concept, it is.
Yeah, honestly, it's hard to not come up with any movie that goes into one of these weird abstract places and not draw a correlation to Alice in Wonderland. Because again, Alice in Wonderland is sort of like one of those underlying archetypes that kind of set the mold for everything that came afterwards.
Mm. Oh, this is I'm not actually trying to go anywhere on the political fence with this note, but I just once we show up at the Queen's Castle, I was like, I assume this is how Mar-a-Lago runs. But
this isn't related to Mar-a-Lago. This is another interesting note that one of the reviews I was reading mentioned that all of Wonderland was actually a memory palace, which is one of my favorite topics ever. I don't know how much I agree with it specifically, but I do think that there is enough there to sort of like debate whether or not Wonderland as a whole could represent a memory palace.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. It just doesn't correspond well with her memories, I guess. Unless she just plays in the grass with bugs a lot, then I guess maybe it does. Maybe she does.
If you could really tell the difference between one patch of grass and the other, then I guess it is.
Well, I guess that would make sorry, it's not the Red Queen, it's the Queen of Hearts. And you mix them up, right? So the Queen of Hearts palace, I mean, that could be just her own home and, you know, aristocratic sort of Victorian rules and things in place.
Well, yeah, actually, that's another good point, because in the book, more so than either of the movies, but the Red Queen or the Queen of Hearts, she actually is the most logical of anyone else in the entire story. She's the one that doesn't deviate from logic. She's the one that even in the cartoon calls out the cards because they're trying to change reality of these white roses they planted and they're trying to paint them red. She again is like the actual judge and jury of reality, saying like, no, you're not allowed to change reality, cut off your heads, because she is so focused on logic and reason and not deviating from that, whereas everyone else in that entire, you know, Wonderland is the opposite of that. Although that doesn't really hold up the same way in the live action movies, because then in the live action movie, it's a lot more magical.
Right. And then you got Helena Bonham Carter just playing her, you know, completely mad off her duff. Right. So
who is a Rothschild? We have to mention that if we're talking about conspiracies. Helena Bonham Carter is absolutely a blood related Rothschild. So.
But you do have to wonder what kind of blood you have, you know. What is my grandmother's family? They got a family crest, Rittenhouse. I'm like, well, that's got some weird. I remember there's a TV show where they replaced Rothschild with Rittenhouse as sort of like the shadow bads. And I was like, hey, that's my family name.
They didn't want to trigger any of the JDL or ADL sort of letters, so they were like, we're gonna choose the Rittenhouse.
Yeah, but then I was like, yeah, so but that does make me think, like, hey, who's in my past? I know, like, my dad's side of the family used to have a fair amount of money around Delmarva, and there's a lake, Lake Comages, but apparently I'm like, so what happened? And there, someone blew it at the horse track. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a good story. And yeah, you're like, hey, there's a lake named after a family. Why isn't it? Why, you know, what happened? So yeah, who knows what, you know, seven generations forward and back are supposed to matter, right? So who knows what happened?
Yep, statistically speaking, you're either related to Genghis Khan or you're related to King King Edward V or something, right?
Yeah. Have you ever, this is especially true in Japan, a lot of children have kind of a, not quite a birthmark, but like on their lower back, there's a big, it looks like a bruise. Do you have any clue what I'm talking about?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, because there's been issues actually when people like went to America or whatever and someone's like, oh, you're abusing your child, there's a bruise. But it's actually this kind of, it's like shows up at birth and it tends to go away after a few years, but the the old wives' tale is that means you're a descendant of Genghis Khan.
I never heard that. It's interesting as hell, man.
But yeah, that is something. If you ever see like a Japanese and maybe other East Asian folks, sometimes if you do see them at the pool, you'll be like, oh my God, are they abusing their kid or something? Because it looks like a bruise, but it's actually normal.
No, that's just the Genghis Khan.
Exactly. The other one that you see a lot in Japan that I guess the way they give childhood shots, they have this one weird like 9-pin thing. So you'll see kids that even adults that still have the scar from that. So that's pretty wild. Just having a permanent scar on your arm from that. But yeah, there's things you don't really see till you get here. Is there any other big points you want to throw out on Allison?
I don't think so, man. I think we covered like a lot of the cool Lewis Carroll Rosicrucianism and maybe that he was a Mason, although maybe not. Really that MK Ultra and Kubar counterintelligence interrogation guide was one of the cooler things that I came up with. Because it's one of those things that you hear very often, oh, MK Ultra and CIA and Alice in Wonderland, but here it actually is right from the CIA, not even denied anymore. As of 2006, you know, you can submit your own FOIA request and get this document, but you also have to go through that effort. You can just find someone else that's already done it and read it and just see, like, they absolutely took inspiration from Lewis Carroll's work in logic and trends, you know, basically like compiling logic into grammar. And then as you read that grammar, your brain turns it back into logic, and it like does the same weird logic shit to your brain that like reading the math equations would do. You know, like the math equation would jumble your brain in a way that would be like, well, this doesn't work because of the logic, and somehow turning that into grammar. I really, truly, honestly believe that deep down he unlocked something that the CIA then has been able to sort of, you know, or other intelligence agencies and secret societies and Rosicrucians and stuff, but they've taken that work, or maybe some of what Lewis Carroll put into that work that made it so timeless came from these Rosicrucian teachings, which might be similar things that are now used by intelligence agencies. But I absolutely believe that between his use of grammar and rhetoric and, you know, that the whole cacophony aspect of it and this introduction of logic, there's something so deep and timeless with this story that it's almost impossible to put your finger on specifically, but it's the reason why it's going to last another 100 years plus, I think.
No, I'm sitting here thinking, I mean, obviously it informs CIA logic, but how much did it create, you know, modern thought? Like before that, I mean, you look at the animation, well, for adults to stay, it's all like ridiculous, absurdist humor. You know, memes are just usually ridiculous, absurdist humor. And I'm like, before Alice in Wonderland, that can't think. I mean, all I can think is like Jonathan Swift or something, you know?
No, there was, man. There's some really cool creations from this time period. There's one called Etta Thorpa, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. It's essentially Aphrodite spelt backwards, and it is incredibly surreal. There's like a land of mushrooms and the weird aliens with like no eyeballs and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think this came from, it came after Alice in Wonderland was written, but it came way before the movies. It was like late 1800s or early 1900s or something. There was a long stint of this like weird abstract stuff and like weird stories that didn't have as much sense. Again, like Alice in Wonderland stands out the most because there's something deeper there. There's like this freaking formula that's baked into the grammar that I don't think exists in any of these other sort of absurdist novels.
Yeah, I guess the one to my mind that would come closest is the Flatland book, which, you know, also kind of mathematical thinking there.
Isn't that like 70s though, or does it predate that?
Take a look. I feel like there is a Victorian era book that.
Oh, yeah, 1884.
Okay, yeah.
That's a great example, yeah.
Yeah, so that, to me, that, I guess, after Alice, that's why I would think of. But it is around this time, I guess, Maybe because people had a little more time on their hands, even in some of the lower rungs of society, right? You don't need to farm like every day anymore. You still have to work in the factory 6 days a week at this point. So that sucks. But just to start a modern thought, we have a little more time to stew on stuff. And when you do that, it gets wacky.
Have you ever heard of the book called Erewhon, which is Nowhere spelt backwards?
No. Once you said
this hasn't come up before, yeah, I'm surprised because it's like one of my favorite books to bring up. But this is 1872, and it was written by a guy named Samuel Butler. And sort of like how The Carpenter and the Walrus is sort of like self-contained story in the middle of a bigger story inside of Erewhon, which is about this guy that finds like a secret utopian society where they've outlawed getting sick so that like no one in society is a criminal. No one's ever sick because the second you do anything wrong or the second you get sick or you hurt yourself, you're basically thrown in jail. So they maintain this absolutely perfect society. But within this whole story, which in itself is like an interesting sort of tale, there's this thing called the law of machines or the book of laws of machines or something. And it essentially lays out rules for artificial intelligence and like robotics and how to design robots so that they can't sort of like work against humans. And again, for something being written in 1872, it's one of these really weird, cool, like prophetic sci-fi novels that's worth checking out.
Yeah, actually, maybe you have mentioned it before, and that's why I recognize the name. But just one more absurdist book before we... this is 1930, but have you come across a Gatsby? Not Great Gatsby, but Gatsby.
I don't think so, no.
It's not a great book, but the weird thing about it is the book does not contain the letter E. So okay. It's like a 150-page novel that does not contain the letter E, which is just kind of wild. So, I mean, you just read a little bit of it, like, how does he work his way around that, you know? So, but very much in Wonderland thinking. I'm going to write a book and it's not going to have E in it. So,
did they just pull out the number 3 in place of all the E's and call it a day?
No, I think he stays pretty legit about it. I don't believe it cheats because you just find other ways to say it, you know, and the language becomes very weird and unreadable, of course, but you have to be impressed that he pulled it off.
So. And I would say, too, not a book that would be as easy to read as Alice in Wonderland, but I think James Joyce had Ulysses.
Yeah, I knew you were about to say that. Or Finnegan's Wake. I like reading that there you go. Sometimes.
So more really great examples of just like an absolute mastery and domination of grammar and language and used in a way that it's almost, again, like secret cheat codes that are like doing things to your brain that you don't realize just by reading it and making the sounds. They kind of like they awaken something weird inside you. And I think that's Lewis Carroll and maybe James Joyce are probably the two ones that come up until you start getting into like weird niche NLP sort of like, you know, reference books.
Well, you got to get blackout drunk and read Finnegan's Wake, right? That's how it's like when you lose
that
your
sounds
keys.
Like that's a wild night there, man.
We got to get in his mindset. Do it. I guess we'll wrap up today. So this is actually, you can tell us what's going on right now because I'm gonna put this up within like 2 or 3 days. So what's up in your
The biggest thing is that we finally got in print little under 1,000 copies of the Chosen One comic book, which is with a comic book that I'm publishing through paranoidamerican.com, and it features the adventures of Juan from the One on One podcast and a few other podcasters, and they just kind of like go through flat earth and they find Tartaria and they go out into outer space onto Saturn and they fight these like huge Gnostic mech Voltron style monsters. It's kind of like a wild tale, and it's kind of cool because we've got it placed in a bunch of head shops and sort of off the beaten path sort of retailers all along the West Coast. I think a lot of them are in Portland and like surrounding areas in California. And then we're going to get them placed somewhere on the East Coast. But that'll be available. Hopefully by the time you're listening to this, you'll be able to find links to that on the Paranoid American Etsy store, but also on the oneononepodcast.com website.
Of course, do seek it out. But I feel like the absolute best experience for that would probably be like stumbling on it and just not knowing what it was.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Which unfortunately, if you're listening to this, you're already past that point. But I can imagine that would just be fantastic. As for this, we're doing a Disney, a call to call it Disney. I guess we're still affiliated on the Oral Hygiene Podcast. So you can contact us around Oral Hygiene Pod on Facebook or Twitter. And we have a bunch of podcasts under the Patreon umbrella of Podcastio Podcastius, where you also talk about sci-fi films, The Twilight Zone, Pokemon, and Monster Hunter. Although I don't really talk about the last two because I don't know anything about them. Okay, let's go find another rabbit hole to trip on down into.